Welcome to another episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Doc Eel. Today, my guest was Oliver Maroney of Dime Magazine. We talked about the trade deadline, the Boston Celtics, the Washington Wizards, the Portland Trail Blazers. We talked about the All-Star Game and all the festivities that go with that. Talked about post-All-Star Game storylines, the race for the eighth seed in the East and the Western Conference. All in all, a great conversation with Oliver. So you ready to tip it off? Oliver, how you doing, man?
Not bad, man. Not bad at all. I'm doing good. I'm here in rainy Portland, Oregon, and it's been an interesting time in the NBA, huh?
Yeah, it's been things are quite picking up, getting really interesting. Trade deadline's a week from now. We have All-Star weekend basically this weekend, so always makes things interesting. Let's just dive right into it. You know, the trade deadline is kind of like a arms race almost. And, you know, it started with the Cavs getting Kyle Korver. The Raptors made their move, you know, 2 days ago getting Serge Ibaka. You know, what, you know, when I look at it now, you know, do Boston and Washington have to make a move? Like, what's, you know, it's one of those things. It's a deterrent. You know, what are your thoughts there?
I don't think either need to make a move, to be quite honest. I think that Boston's in a pretty good position right now with what they have going. Yes, they've got a ton of draft picks, and I've said it before that I think they should make a move, but if they don't, I don't think it's the end of the world. They're playing pretty well. I don't think anybody expects them to make the finals. I think that Eastern Conference Finals should be where their heads are at, and I think that's entirely possible based on the landscape in the Eastern Conference. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them make a move, but do they need to make a move? Nah, not necessarily. If they want to be in contention, sure, why not? But you know, being in the arms race, I guess you could call it, is not, you know, to me, sometimes it's not worth it. And I think for a team like Boston, when you have these draft picks, when you have a lot of young guys on your roster and players that can continue to improve and grow and get better, I think you stick it out as long as you possibly can at being a 2, 3, or 4 seed in the Eastern Conference until either LeBron bows out or the Cavs lose a piece or potentially the Raptors end up losing Lowry in the offseason, maybe even Ibaka as well because he's a free agent as well. So I think you take your time and just let things fall where they may. And I think that's probably the best for them overall, just because if you really want to be put in pole position to contend, obviously you've got to be up there with the LeBrons and with the Golden State Warriors. And I just don't see that happening. They would have to move so many pieces and so many different things in order to get a piece that's going to really, really change the tone of their team. And it's a really high risk, high reward situation. You go after a guy like Boogie, and obviously he's got the off the court problems. You go after, and I mean, I can go down the list of players, but they all have their own problems. And there's nothing really that's clear cut and says, yes, this makes this team that much better that they could contend against a LeBron Cavaliers team or Golden State Warriors, Kevin Durant and Curry and Clay and Draymond team. So for Boston specifically, no. For Washington, same thing. They're young, they're developing, they're growing, they're improving. There's no reason for them to make a move just to make a move. And the guys out there on the market right now just don't really seem, like I said, it's high risk, high reward. I just don't really like the landscape right now in the trade market. I don't think it's very valuable. And I think teams, as the season starts to close and as the draft picks up, I think that's when you could see some moves happen because of the desperation of some of these teams.
Yeah, I agree with you on Boston and that they don't have to make a move. I disagree with you a bit on Washington. I think they need to do something about their bench if they really want to compete. I mean, they've been on a hell of a run so far, but I don't know how much longer they could sustain. You know, their bench is just so weak to me, you know, and I think you can possibly get a guy like Lou Williams from the Lakers for, you know, maybe a draft pick. I'm sure they'll shed some salary as well, but I kind of think that might be something there. I mean, I just feel like Washington, if they really want to take that next step, is they need to find somebody with the bench, you know, to help them on their bench. And Lou Williams is on a pretty good deal. He has another year left at, I think, $7 million. So I'm kind of watching that for them. You know, when it comes to Boston, they definitely shouldn't make a big move and not move any of those draft picks till draft time. I think that's when they look to really shake it up. The One thing I want to ask you about, though, is who's Danny Ainge going to say that they had a deal in place for at the last second but chose not to do it? I mean, it feels like every year at the deadline, you know, afterwards he comes out with a story that they could have got a superstar.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to hear him say Jimmy Butler or someone along those lines. I've been one that I think Boston is a perfect fit for a guy like Jimmy Butler. I think that's an opportunity that Boston should take up if they were offered anything like that, because I think that Butler is a transcendent superstar that could continue to grow and improve, especially under a guy like Brad Stevens, who coaches defense first. The thing about Boston to me that's so intriguing is not just Danny Ainge and like his amazing, I think his amazing move since he's been there, specifically talking about obviously the Brooklyn trade and all that stuff, but more importantly, Brad Stevens is a coach. I think that this guy is like one in a million when you're talking about coaches. And the only reason I say that is you look at a player like Isaiah Thomas. He's offensively one of the most gifted players in the NBA, and he's defensively probably one of the worst. And it's no knock on him or anything else, but what he's been able to accomplish with basically hiding all the weaknesses of Isaiah Thomas on a team that, you know, basically has a ton of very good defensive-minded players is incredible. You know, the point guard position is one of the strongest in the NBA, and if you can't play defense against a point guard, you've seen it in Portland, you've seen it elsewhere. If you can't play defense in the backcourt, then you struggle in the NBA. And for whatever reason, he's been a mastermind at working this together and putting plus defenders around Isaiah Thomas and hiding all of his deficiencies on defense and just letting him explode on offense. So that's another thing that I take away from Boston is I don't know if they necessarily need like the guy, the Boogie Cousins or someone like that when you have a coach like Brad Stevens, because they're one in a million. To me, he's up there with Pop or Kerr as far as coaches go right now, just because of the way, you know, the great coaches hide those deficiencies and weaknesses. And there's not many of them out there that you can pinpoint and say, wow, this guy, he's changing the way this team plays in a good way. So I really like what Boston's doing. And I think that if they get the draft picks and they can run with them in the summer league and prove how valuable and how good these players are, then you may look at a move and teams are going to start to salivate over these players that they picked up. And that's when you get the most value and bang for your buck.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on there, and your Brad Stevens assessment is spot on. I'm a big fan of his. I love watching what he does, you know, out of timeouts and all sorts of plays he puts together and putting guys in the right position. He's the best young coach in the NBA, and he's going to be one of the few guys to have made the leap from college to the pros, and let alone from a mid-major college at Butler to go straight to the pros. It's pretty impressive. Getting off Boston a little bit and the really kind of the big four of the East, you know, the Blazers and Nuggets made a trade. I know you're up in Portland. It's very rare you see an 8 and 9 seed make a trade for each other when they're both fighting for the same playoff spot. You know, what was your take on the trade? What'd you think, you know, Plumlee for Yusuf Nurkic, you know, in a draft pick? What were your thoughts?
It's a good deal for both teams. I think it was marketably better than what I thought Portland would be able to do with an expiring Plumlee, essentially. So they couldn't pay him. They weren't going to pay him. They were going to let him walk this offseason anyways. And they ended up getting Nurkic and a first-round pick for him. And, you know, last night we saw Nurkic play meaningful minutes and did pretty well in the time that he was on the floor. Do I think he's going to be able to keep it up or sustain it? I don't know. I don't think he's necessarily the answer for the future as far as centers go in Portland. I just think that his defense, from what a lot of Portland fans think, his defense is incredibly better than any of the players they have in the front court. And I slightly disagree with that. I think that he's a little bit too slow to run pick and roll defense, and I think he has some deficiencies that haven't really been shown yet, just in his short tenure with the Portland Trailblazers. So. Yeah, everybody's getting their hopes up here, and I'm one to be very hesitant on this guy right now just because of what he showed in Denver and kind of the attitude that comes with him. You know, it's going to take a while, I think, for me to come around on that, on him specifically. But the trade overall, good for both teams. I don't think either team is going to be changed dramatically one way or the other. But I do think the Nuggets, it does signal the Nuggets are in win now mode. I think they think, look, this is our chance to make a run at least into the playoffs. And I don't blame them. They've been out of the playoffs forever. So to get into the playoffs and give that fan base something to at least to cheer for would be a good thing for them.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. The other thing that's interesting about the trade on the Portland side is they now have three draft picks in the upcoming draft. You know, and they, if I'm, my understanding is correct, they actually have a full roster for next year already without the draft picks. So, you know, is this, you think, a precursor to more moves, you know, whether at the deadline or draft day?
No doubt. No doubt at all. There's no way they're keeping three draft picks. I think they have 13 guaranteed contracts on their roster right now. And they add the three draft picks in there, and you would typically always add first round draft picks to your roster. People who say that you could draft a player and then just waive him afterwards, that's ridiculous. That's crazy talk. So
I think the closest you get is a draft and stash kind of thing. You take a European project and
sure. You could do that, but in this draft, I think there is so much talent that you could probably, I mean, there's not many, I don't think there's many overseas guys that I would take in the spots that Portland would be looking at potentially. It'll be interesting to see either way, but I just don't see them keeping all three draft picks. I don't think it's very logical, first of all, because that only gets you younger and you're going to have to develop that potential again. And I've said it many times, it is a lot easier. It's easier said than done when you're trying to convert prospects and college players into NBA players and like confident, consistent NBA players. So I find it hard to believe that they'd go through the rebuilding kind of process again. I think they're definitely going to make another move, whether it be a couple of those draft picks, just one of them. And Neil Olshay came out the other day and said, I think the question was, are you still going to make moves? And the answer was very, very short and confident. It was just like, we're active, I think was the answer in quote. So
a very Neil answer. I've worked with him. He's the one that got me into the NBA. So very Neil answer.
No, yeah. I mean, he's worked wonders in this run. I mean, like, for the most part, like, we talk about this offseason, people are going to critique him and say, you paid Evan Turner too much money, et cetera. But for the most part, he's made some marvelous moves. I mean, he got he traded Jeff Withey for Robin Lopez. So
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and picked up Al-Farouq Aminu when everybody said $10 million a year for Al-Farouq Aminu was way too much. So, you know, he's done a lot of good things, and I've always said, like, not in Neil we trust, but essentially, until he starts making bad decisions and you can see the long-term negativity towards those moves, I don't think you should be untrustworthy of what he's doing. I think he's making moves, not just to make moves, but to make the team better overall for now and in the future. So, both teams are getting better. And it'll be interesting to see if they trade the draft picks or not, but it would be shocking to me if they keep them.
Right. Well, at least all three. That's just too many. But I kind of want to go back to it because I actually disagree with people when they talk about Evan Turner, you know, his contract. I mean, it was a lot of money and all of that, and that you might have been able to get him for less. But when you look at what he was able to do when they moved him into the starting lineup and kind of it did elevate the play of the Blazers a bit. You know, they were going on a better run. He was playing much better, looked much more comfortable. I mean, it obviously just bad timing with the broken hand, but I really thought, like, Blazers were about to go on a run at that point up until he got hurt. So I'm a big Turner fan, so it's not surprising, you know, when I say it to people, but it's I don't look at it as that was really kind of a bad move. I just think, you know, they at first weren't using him right. I feel like he's at his best when he's on the court with Dame and CJ and letting those guys run off screens and playmaking for them and making it easier for them.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah, I would agree there. And I was one on the Evan Turner, like, pump the brakes on him being a bust or him being a bad signing as well. I think that he brings a lot to the table. The one problem I had more or less in the offseason was just the issue I had was more bringing Allen Crabbe back and signing Evan Turner, because the two moves together really didn't make logical sense. And the only reason they don't make logical sense, like, if you want a deep roster, go ahead, sign those guys up. I you know, the more the merrier. But on paper, it looks great, you know. But there's attitudes and emotions that are involved with, you know, playing the game of basketball professionally. And Evan Turner's used to playing 25, 30 minutes a night. Alan Crabb was used to playing 20, 25 minutes a night last season. And now you're splitting time between those two guys behind, you know, CJ and Dame. So that's where it got a little bit confusing and tricky. And that's, I think, where everything starts to go wrong, is when guys don't feel comfortable in the roles that they're put in, or they don't feel like they're getting enough meaningful minutes. That's where the defense slacks off. That's where, you know, that's the first thing to go, is defense. Like most NBA players, that's where it goes. Anytime you're emotionally distressed in any sort of way, or just don't feel comfortable in the role that you're in, the defense is the first to go. And that was evident and clear for the start of the season through, I'd say, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, right? And so that's where I think all the problems started, was just, you know, guys having expectations on them and feeling like they knew their role better than the coaching staff, and the coaching staff putting them in different positions that weren't necessarily the best for those players, or what the players thought was the best for them. So that's where I think everything kind of fell apart. It's not necessarily on Neil Olshey. He put it together as best as he could on paper. Problem is, you know, the game isn't played on paper, and there's obviously a ton of variables that are involved with players' mindsets and emotions and how they play and how they feel comfortable. So,
yeah, the last bit about, you know, Olshey, and then we'll move on. But, you know, I feel like that move to bring Crabb back in was more just not losing an asset for nothing. And and down the road, there's value in either Turner or Crabb, or, you know, having both of them means you can move one of them at one point for
another, no doubt,
for another piece. So
makes sense.
I think that's kind of the thought process, and that's all speculation on my end. There's no definitive proof behind anything. So, but that's what we're here for.
No, it makes sense. No, yeah,
nothing but speculation. Since we're talking about GMs, I did want to bring this up. Was what's your take on Magic Johnson as the advisory role for the Lakers? He's been on almost every media outlet possible at this point, talking about how he wants to take over and he wants to have final say and everything and all of that. What's your opinion on that so far? I mean, it's early. We actually haven't seen him make a move or anything, or we don't even know how deeply involved he is in decision making. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on this, because I think that there is a extremely high upside bringing in a guy like Magic Johnson because of a couple reasons. First of all, the namesake. I mean, as much as people want to move that out of the way, it's still there. And I think free agents, especially kids who are getting drafted, bringing Magic Johnson into the draft room, or you know, the practices or the meetings that these players have with the GMs or the coaching staffs, I think it's huge. And I think players will want to play in LA because Magic Johnson's a part of the team and a part of the organization. Him coming out to media outlets and saying, I want to be the guy, I want to take over, I want to do all this, pump the brakes, buddy. That's the one thing I got to say about that. It's just, it's a little bit too soon for that sort of stuff to be happening. And I think it does come across just a little bit condescending to the guys that are already there. So that's my only concern. But I mean, as far as Magic Johnson as a, you know, a free agent, added value, I think he's huge, because, you know, like I said, a lot of players look up to a guy like Magic Johnson. That's who they grew up watching play. That's who they've seen game tape on. He has his namesake. He's got the historicals. He's got everything. And I think that will be a huge selling point for players who are not necessarily just point guards, but just players in the NBA who grew up watching those great Laker teams. So I think there is a huge upside for that. And I think, you know, where the Lakers have failed in the past couple of seasons, it's free agent meetings and that whole situation. I mean, obviously they absolutely botched the LaMarcus Aldridge situation. And I think that's where Johnson brings added value and expertise where no one else could.
Right. I look at it kind of, you know, he was in the Melo free agency meeting and that didn't work out. Obviously, we don't know how much involvement he had and all that. I agree with you on there's definite upside in having Magic as part of your organization and even as a face of the franchise. And I don't know how much in terms of him being a decision maker you know, that all remains to be seen how he handles that and all that. But to me, like, the promotional tour is just kind of weird, especially this time of year with the draft deadline coming up. You know, I mentioned to you, you know, you could possibly move in Lou Williams. You know, there's definitely there could be deals out there, and I kind of feel like this would be time better served for him to get more of an understanding of what's the current situation in the front office. So I'm a bit surprised and a bit perturbed by it, but you know, I don't. We'll see how it all shakes out in the long run, but you know, I was just kind of curious because I've never seen a front office exec kind of campaign like this. I'm almost expecting it one day to see a Magic Johnson tweet announcing a trade.
Yeah, maybe that'd be interesting. I don't know if players would necessarily. And the only thing I don't like about the promotional tour, as you call it, is just the idea that what players, like prospective players, will be thinking about that. Because I don't know if I'm a GM of an organization, I'm not going out and promoting my team or promoting what I'm doing with my team. It seems like you're almost taking credit for what the guys on the floor are doing instead of what your job is. And that's where I could see a problem with it. Similar kind of to the Phil Jackson situation, way less stringent than what that is, but it's very similar. You don't really want to go to the media. Like, the great organizations in this league, like Kerr doesn't really say that much. And when he does, it's a big deal. Popovich, same thing. He'll come out and say the honest truth, but they're not telling you about anything. They're not going out and saying, I'm the best coach in the world. I'm going to run the house in this. I'm the decision maker. They're not saying it like that. So, and that's what I think the Lakers need to kind of model after, is a team like that. And now I think every NBA team wants to model after that. But if you're to do that, you can't be going around and promoting you being the guy and you making all the shots and all the rest of it. Because I think that obviously devalues the franchise. I think it devalues the players that are playing on the court at the current moment, because I think that you're taking the credit for their success or failure, depending on what the situation is. So I don't know. It's a little bit interesting to me, but we'll see how it actually plays out.
Yeah. We'll see in the long run of how this all works itself out I say the same word like four times in one sentence. We'll just see how it all plays out. Let's jump into more fun stuff right now and talk about the All-Star game. The All-Star weekend coming up. You know, we have the skills competition, the dunk contest, the three-point shootout. You know, give me your favorites to win each of those.
You know, I would say, so dunk competition, I've got Glenn Robinson III. I think I'm going to stick with that pick. That is the guy that I think is going to win it, even though people are putting Jones Jr. or Aaron Gordon on that pedestal. And then when we look at the three-point contest, I think Klay's probably going to win it again. He's just too good of a shooter, in my opinion, and he's got the stroke down. His mechanical form is probably the best that I've seen in the past, like, 10 or 15 years. Ray Allen's up there, obviously. Beal has very good form as well, but yeah, Klay Thompson probably. And the skills challenge, I've never really thought much of the skills challenge anyways, so I'll bow out of that one.
Fair enough. It's kind of like a weird format where they do like bigs versus guards kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I would say for the skills challenge, I'm going to just bet on John Wall. I think the favorite has been Isaiah Thomas so far, but I feel like the skills challenge includes some passing, and I'm not sure where Isaiah's passing is really.
Jokic is in there, isn't he?
Jokic is in there.
I'll pick Jokic for fun. Why not?
There you go. There we go. The dunk contest is interesting to me because I really like. I was looking at the line, and you know, I don't gamble often, but when I do, I really kind of get a little crazy with it, and I'm like, is there any chance DeAndre Jordan can pull this off? I mean, he's a plus 2,000 in one of the gambling lines I saw. And I was just kind of like, I know seven footers don't do well except for Dwight Howard. But is there any chance DJ could do something? Like, what are your thoughts with DJ in the dunk contest? Is it kind of weird? I'm just curious. Like, I want to bet on him.
I've seen some incredible dunks from DJ. The problem is that there's already kind of, it's almost like we're predispositioned to believe a 7-footer should be able to dunk and he should be able to do things. So it's less valuable, I guess you could say. And that's where I find the biggest problem with DJ is just the fact that he's taller than most of the contestants there. And he's, you know, everyone's seen some of the dunks he's already done. Now, could he come out with something incredible? Could he sell the crowd? I think DJ is probably going to come out with the most sales pitchy dunks out of everyone, just my opinion of it, because he can't lift off like a guy like Aaron Gordon or a guy like Derrick Jones Jr. So he's going to have to do something to make it not necessarily gimmicky, but just like, you know, throw in props, throw in things that are different, which we saw Blake Griffin did pretty well with that. So that's where the outsider's chance kind of comes in. If I'm to choose a sleeper though, and I already said this, but GR3 is the guy. And I know he was, I think last time I checked, plus 700, plus 800, somewhere in there. And that's a pretty good bet when you only have a 1 in 4 chance. If you go to his Instagram page, there are some teasers. And his head is a good, I don't know the footage, but his head is way above the rim. And there's some stuff on there. I've looked at some of his dunks. I've gone through the research, and there's just a lot to make me believe that he's going to be the guy that wins this thing. Now, the big thing that I think DJ has ahead of almost any dunker in this is obviously he's played in the NBA for a longer period of time. He knows the bright lights. He's been in big crowds. He's been in playoff moments. So chances of him screwing up a dunk compared to the other three are probably way less slim, in my opinion. And that's something you do have to take into consideration when you talk about the dunk contest, because there is a little bit of goosebumps involved. There's a lot more people watching, and that definitely changes things. So, yeah, DJ has an outside shot. I don't think it's really realistic to think that he could win it, but, you know, last year nobody expected Aaron Gordon to be anywhere near what Zach LaVine was, and I think he probably won it, in my opinion. Right. So, yeah.
He was robbed last year, for sure.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, that under the legs one was pretty impressive. I think that, I mean, the dunk competition will go down as one of the best we've ever seen, I think, when it's all said and done. But this year's one, people are saying that it's not as good because you don't have LaVine in there. I completely disagree. I think this is probably the strongest four that we've seen in the dunk competition in the past 10 or so years, when you go through all four. Just like the difference in size, athletic ability, the way they dunk, the motions they use, and then the dunks that you've already seen from these guys, they're all really impressive. So if they can pull out some tricks out of the bag, I know I just did a story actually on the guy behind the scenes who kind of teaches these dunkers how to dunk and what they should be doing, et cetera. And he sounds extremely excited about this dunk competition and what could be a very, very good one this year.
I'm excited for, you know, Glenn Robinson III and Derrick Jones Jr. Just because I think, like, this is fun. Like, two guys we don't really know about. Jones especially really kind of played most of his time in the D-League this year. I'm kind of excited to see these guys have a chance to make a name for themselves. So I sort of applaud the NBA a little bit also for going for a couple of unknowns who this can really make them something for a little bit, and kind of put them on the map. So I'm a bit excited for those guys. My quick for the 3-point contest, I'm with you. It's Clay. It's his to lose kind of thing. When you look at the game, and I'm not a big fan of the game. I generally don't watch the game for the most part. I'll check out the highlights later. But who do you look at, East or West? Who do you think is gonna? What's your prediction on winning it?
I think this year specifically, I think the West takes the cake. On the actual game, if we're talking about that. As far as MVPs are concerned, I would not be surprised to see LeBron win the MVP this year. I think that obviously the West has a couple different players that could potentially do something. Russell Westbrook will be the stat junkie that he always is, and he could potentially win it as well. And I think a sleeper pick for MVP, I know that, well, it's not really even a sleeper, but I think Harden could also be an MVP too, just based on the past, you know, season or so, showing how good he's been with just like making plays off and on the ball and actually being more of a facilitator. I think that definitely helps him in this sort of instance. I think he could end up with like 15, 20 assists in this game easily. And because of how high scoring it is, and he's going to have all the lobs and all the alley-oops to guys. And I think that's a huge benefit. So he may end up winning the MVP, but I think the West runs away with this thing by like 15, 20 points. You know, it's going to be like 150 to 170 or whatever the score line is.
I agree with you on the West. Two names I think to keep an eye out in terms of possible MVPs is Kawhi Leonard and Anthony Davis. Obviously Davis, because it's in New Orleans and he's going to want to come out and show the crowd. So I always feel like there's a little – I always watch for the hometown guys a little bit. Kawhi, I think, has just been on a great tear lately. You know, if he can kind of keep it going, and I think guys are going to feed him and find him in the right spots. So it'll be interesting to see that. But I think you're right. And LeBron, Westbrook, Harden, they all can make a run at it. Even KD and Steph, for that matter. So it'll be interesting in that regards.
Yeah, the Golden State guys specifically, when you talk about the Golden State guys, I'm wary of picking any of them because I think that, you know, obviously with the coach and everything else, they have the advantage of getting a little more rest than everyone else. So I think there could be a little bit of that going on as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see that too, if Kerr is kind of just like, you guys should just hang out for a little bit.
Let's not get you injured, okay? Let's just keep this simple.
Yeah, everybody chill out. But speaking of chilling out, I got to ask you, it's a bit random. I do this on every episode. What's the gelato scene like in Portland?
It's pretty minuscule in the scheme of things. We've got a couple good hot spots, but it's pretty small in the scheme of things.
Well, I got a place here in downtown LA. It's in the Spring Arcade. It's called Uli's Gelateria. It's by far the best gelato shop I've been to. I have my favorite flavors of Speculoos cookies and sea salt caramel, but they have so many assortments of flavors, and it's cool. You can go there and taste it and everything like that. Great staff. Everybody there is pretty awesome. So if you're in LA at any point, Oliver, I highly recommend heading downtown, Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street on Spring Street, obviously. Go check it out, my man.
Yeah, definitely will. No doubt about it. As long as they have like fruit flavor, I'm a big fruit gelato guy. I like the fruit flavored gelatos. Not a huge fan of like sea salt caramel, and it's getting too ice creamy for me. I like having the fruits, like the strawberry or something along those lines. But yeah, I'm definitely down, no doubt about it.
They won't disappoint, my man. I promise you, they won't disappoint you. just go check it out. You know, if you're in town, and it's not far from me, man. So just, you know, let me know you're going. I'll meet you there. I'll be the first to buy you a gelato from Uli's.
Ooh, all right, I'll have to take you up on that.
There we go. This is how I bribe everybody. If people wonder how I get guests, I just constantly bribe them with gelato, and I figure most of them won't ever show up. But jumping back now, you know, post All-Star break, this is my favorite time of year when it comes to basketball besides the playoffs, just because the last like 25, 30 games, everybody's jockeying for position, and every game kind of has a little more importance than it did a few months earlier. So, you know, what are some of the storylines you're looking for and keeping your eye out post All-Star break?
Well, I think the first thing that I'm looking out for is if Boston and Washington can keep up their kind of incredible runs they've had the past couple of months and see if they can keep up with the Toronto Raptors after their acquisition of Ibaka. And that'll be a very intriguing storyline to see who ends up with that 2 seed, because quite frankly, whoever ends up with the 2 seed probably is the most likely to end up in the Eastern Conference Finals in my book. And so it'll be very, very intriguing, that top end. And the bottom of the East and the bottom of the West are both, you know, neck and neck. They've got, you know, Portland, Denver, you know, even a Sacramento in there. They've got a lot of different teams down there that could potentially make a push to get into the playoffs. So those will be interesting as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how Toronto kind of uses Ibaka and integrates him into the flow of things. I kind of think Boston has the 2 seed locked up. They're 3 games ahead of Washington. There's no chance of Toronto really catching them. They're 4.5, if my math is correct, which is something that's always shaky, my math. But I think, you know, I think Boston's kind of got the 2 seed locked up, and I didn't even really think about it, but you're right, though. For Washington not to have home court in the second round, assuming they make it that far and assuming they're playing Boston, that's going to be a big problem for them, being how young they are and not really used to the playoffs. I mean, I know they had that one run, you know, when they had Pearson going after it, but I'm still a relatively young team, so I think not having home court is going to be a big issue for them. the bottom of the playoffs, you know, let's kind of focus on the East here a little bit, because it is pretty tight. You know, 7 and 8 seed are both up for grabs there in the East. You know, you have Chicago at 7, and they're a half game up on Detroit. And right behind Detroit, you know, Milwaukee's a game behind out of the 8 seed. Miami's 2. Charlotte's 2.5. I mean, those are really kind of the contenders to me in terms of the bottom of the 8 seed. You know, what do you think between those five teams, which two are going to make it?
That's tough. That's really tough. Somehow I think Detroit is somehow going to push themselves in there. I don't see Stan Van Gundy giving up on this team yet. I've been sticking by Charlotte for a while, and I don't know why, but whatever reason, I have taken a liking to the way they play basketball. I like Kemba Walker. I like what Nicholas Batum brings to the table, and I just hope that they can somehow figure out what they're going to do to themselves, because they've been on a pretty poor run here the past couple of months. And, you know, they started the season off really hot. I mean, they were one of the hottest teams in the NBA, and now it's like, oof, they may not even make the playoffs at this point.
They're 1-9 in their last 10.
Yeah, it's been pretty atrocious. But, you know, one move here or there, and that could change a lot. And, you know, they wouldn't be a surprise to me to make a move or make a little bit of a splash by getting like an added third option or something like that that could help them in the scoring department. I think they definitely need more of a consistent option on offense. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them make a move. But yeah, I'm going to stick by my picks. I'm going to say Detroit and Charlotte. I was actually at the beginning of the season. I cannot believe I'm going to say this, but I picked the Knicks to somehow make the playoffs. So, yeah, that's how confident I was in that pick. Pretty awesome. So I don't see them anywhere near that mix at this point. And
not, you know, with the drama that they got going. It's
not at all.
And you couldn't have foreseen that.
Yeah, and the other team that I would probably mention would be the Bucks, even though they lost Parker. I think there's an opportunity here where Thon Maker makes a really big improvement over the next 20, 25 games and you know, pushes the Milwaukee Bucks as close as they can be to the playoffs. Now, do they make the playoffs? I don't really think so at this point, but if Middleton can like pick up his play and get back to normal and be the consistent, efficient scorer that he is, I think this team is deadly. And I think that they have a lot of athleticism, obviously, with Giannis and the players that they have. I think they've got some good options there in Milwaukee to potentially make a run as well.
I really like the I'd like Milwaukee to make it, mainly just because I want to watch those guys in the playoffs. I'm happy you brought up Thon Maker. I wasn't really going to do it, but I'll plug my piece. I just wrote something on my website about Thon Maker's development and this being an opportunity for him really to grow. So it sucks to put it on the kid because he's such a young kid and a rookie, but it's almost on him at this point. He's no way he's going to replace Parker, but he needs to bring something to the table that can help them. And they're a game out of it. You know, of the five teams I've listed, they have the highest point differential, which is minuscule because they're at plus 0.3. Most of these other teams are negative. Give you a little love with Charlotte's plus 2, plus 0.2, excuse me.
So, there you go.
So you have a chance there with Charlotte. I'd like to see Milwaukee get it. I think it's going to be – I'm going to go Detroit and Milwaukee. I'm not betting against Stan Van Gundy. I think he's going to find a way to get those guys in there. I know there was rumors of Jackson and Drummond being on the market, so he might be able to find a piece there to get them going. But I think that's going to be – those are going to be my two teams in the East. But I will keep an eye out on Miami just because they've – really kind of come on strong lately, obviously.
Yep.
With that huge win streak. Can't really you can't discount them a bit.
No, Spoelstra's been terrific. I mean, that's to me, I know that's a bad team and I know people have pointed it out many times, but to me, he should be in the coach of the year conversation as much as people, you know, hate having a losing team, basically, or a subpar team, I guess you could say, in the race for coach of the year. But I think he's up there at this point. I mean, look, Cleveland hasn't really done anything to sell them as the best team in the NBA. Golden State, same sort of situation. They've been good, but they are not as good as last year, and people have expectations on them to do better and better. And, you know, you look at a guy like Tony, he's probably the obvious pick just because of how much they've overachieved in Houston so far. And there's a couple other guys you could pinpoint. Brad Stevens, obviously a very good pick as well. Scott Brooks at this point, probably a very good pick as well. And, you know, I think Spoelstra is right in that mix, though. I don't think he's that far. It's not that far-fetched to think that, you know, that team without Spoelstra would be nowhere near or sniffing the playoffs.
Yeah, Coach of the Year is always a funny award to me. I want to say it's Zach Lowe who always said, and I kind of agree with him, but it should always just be Pop. You know, yep. The fact it's not him on a regular basis. Is weird. I always feel like for me, when I want to pick somebody for Coach of the Year, it's kind of like the situation you just described. Somebody who's doing better than we all thought they would do. And that means sometimes it's going to be a team with a losing record. So, you know, I think D'Antoni's going to run away with it, and I think it's deserved. I don't think anybody really expected them to be a 3 seed and on pace to win 50-plus games. But for me, I look at it, and I'm with you. Spoelstra, I think Quinn Snyder's the guy you got to look at. I think the one guy that gets overlooked constantly just because how bad the team is, but Brett Brown deserves a little bit of some love there on the Coach of the Year stuff just because, you know, they're winning games even without Embiid right now. I mean, it's all on McConnell's back. I mean, you know, TJ McConnell's the game winner after game winner now kind of guy. But I always kind of think it's like teams like that those kind of coaches have the toughest job. And it's interesting. So I always want to put those guys in a little bit. I get killed, obviously, the same way as you said. Nobody with a losing record should really have much of a chance at it. But those are interesting stuff right there. But let's jump to the Western Conference and the race there. It's really just down to the 8 seed. 1 through 7 is pretty much – those teams are pretty much locked in. So right now Denver's at the 8. Portland's – a game and a half behind – Sacramento's a game and a half behind them. Portland's 2. And New Orleans, 2.5. And Dallas, 3. Minnesota kind of on the outside at 3.5. What – of those teams there, do you think – who do you think staying in? What's going on?
You know, I actually don't like Portland or Denver in this conversation at all. I just don't – I don't think they have – Portland's got a really easy second half schedule. I think they're the easiest one after the All-Star break, if I'm not mistaken. As far as like wins and losses go, from what I remember, and Denver has a pretty rough pretty hard schedule, from what I recall as well. So those two teams, it's not like, I wouldn't be surprised if either of those teams made it because look at where they are. They're very close to the playoffs, but I actually think it's going to be either the Pelicans or the Mavericks. And I think it's going to come down to one of those two teams. The reason I say the Mavericks is the experience, the veteran leadership. Carlisle's a great coach. He always has been. He gets the most out of every guy on that team. They've had injuries up and down that roster, and they're finally starting to find some sort of consistent play. And, you know, Wes Matthews has been playing outrageously well. Yogi Ferrell seems to have been kind of the spark that they needed. And they've got a lot of, like I said, playoff experience, veteran experience that can get you over the top. So I wouldn't be surprised about Dallas. The reason I say the Pelicans is they have one of the best players in the NBA in Anthony Davis. And they're playing, they've been playing pretty consistently as well. I mean, Drew Holiday's been very good. Buddy Hield is starting to show some signs of life. And I think that team is kind of poised to make a second half run at getting into the playoffs.
Yeah, I'm with you on, I don't think Portland's going to make it. I think the Evan Turner injury really kind of set them back. And by the time he comes back into the fold, it's going to be a bit late. I think, you know, New Orleans and Dallas both have come on strong. One guy in Dallas that kind of gets overlooked is Steph Curry. Sorry. And that's something I screw up all the time. But Seth Curry's really kind of come on strong. I know Yogi Ferrell has really blown up, and it's a great story, D-League to that. But Seth Curry as a journeyman has really kind of stepped up, and he was red hot in January. I recommend everybody kind of go look at the numbers and see what he was doing there, and he kind of help keep him afloat, and never bet against Carlisle. Just, you can't. That being said, I'm going to take a shot there and just, I kind of hope Sacramento makes it. I hope team dysfunction makes it to the playoffs and gets the 8 seed and goes up against Golden State. I mean, I think we saw a little glimpse of the drama yesterday with Draymond Green kind of getting kicked out and stuff. I think it might be fun to watch that in the first round. So I think I'm going to go with Sacramento. You know, you said it, you know, Anthony Davis is one of the best players in the NBA. I think Cousins, if he can just keep his head on straight, and the big thing I'm worried about is now that he's over the technical limit, he's going to miss a few more games because he can't control himself and he's going to get teed up. But if he manages to avoid too many suspensions, I think he can really kind of carry them into the playoffs.
Yeah, no doubt about it, man. No doubt about it. I think, look, Alvin Gentry is another guy that I've kind of been on the lookout for. Not coach of the year wise or anything like that. We're not going that far. But I think that he has done not a great job, especially last year. I didn't think he did a very good job at all. But this season, I think he's been pretty good. He's been able to tinker with lineups, and he's getting the most from guys like Tim Frazier. This roster is not that deep. They're not that good. They're not that talented, but yet they still find themselves, like you said, only about three games out of the playoff situation, and they have one of the best players in the league. So, if you're going by just sheer star power, talent-wise, and what they've done in the past couple of months, I think the Pelicans are right up there, with like an eight seed, kind of deserving of an eight seed, I guess you could say. So I like what they are doing down there in New Orleans. I think Terrence Jones has been pretty good as well. Monty Unis obviously has had some good games with him. So yeah, it seems like things are working out a little bit better than they were at the start of the season for them.
Yeah. And I think you touched on it, and I would make the argument that last year too, he didn't have much of a roster to really work with.
No, not at all. I think he was the guy who was outstated in that, right? He came out and had that big hardcore quote, like, what do I have to work with, or something like that. So,
yeah, it's tough in those situations. So, and they had so many injuries, and even this year, starting off with Drew Holiday missing the time for good reason, to take care of his wife and all of that. But it just kind of puts you up against the wall in that situation. I got one last question for you. You can choose to not answer it if you don't want to, because I know you might have. Keep favor with teams. I used to ask people their favorite league pass teams, but I want to start changing that question to your anti league pass team. Who's the team you see on there and you're just like, no, I'm not watching this team tonight?
Oklahoma City. No doubt about it. Yeah, I hate watching Oklahoma City play. It's hard to watch them play. I don't like it because, to me, I like free flowing basketball. I like the ball being moved around. I like the ball not staying with one player at one particular time. And to me, there's just a huge difference. Like, go ahead and turn on any team in the NBA. I'd rather watch the Philadelphia 76ers or, even to an extent, the Minnesota Timberwolves are one of these lower-end teams right now over a team like the Oklahoma City Thunder, because you know exactly what's going to happen.
Right. Shooting it.
Russell Westbrook's going to get a triple-double. He's going to go score as many points as he possibly can. The passing is limited at best. Everybody else can't shoot on that team. I'm killing them right now. They're in the seventh seed. They're not leaving that spot, I don't think. And I don't think they're a bad team by any means. But watching wise, like visually, entertainment value, I know a lot of people love Russell Westbrook for what he does, and I am one of those people. He's extremely athletic. He has all the talent in the world. But for me, visually speaking, just like watching the game of basketball, it's not exactly the most fun to watch one player get all the touches and do everything that he's doing. I know his teammates aren't great, and I know he's probably up there in the MVP conversation because of how good he's been this year. Not disputing that at all. But watching-wise, I think I'm just kind of bored of it. I know that sounds crazy, and it's probably a little bit selfish, but yeah, that's one of the teams.
I'm with you on that. For me, it's Brooklyn. It's hard to watch a team that's lost 14 games in a row. It's just not enough talent on the floor. I was very excited when they started the season 4-5, and I thought like, oh, they're going to put up a fight most nights, and they've gotten a few wins, but now it feels like that time's over. any fun times for them? I like what you said about Westbrook, because I'll say this much. I'm really tired of the Westbrook-Durant sort of fake feud thing they got going, and the whole all of, last Saturday's game where, the TV played it up and the fans with the cupcakes and the whole thing. It's like, bro, they're the top team in the West. They've only lost 9 games. You're really kind of just barking up the wrong door. It's just like it's really just kind of annoying in that sense. I'm a bit tired of the whole drama behind the Durant Westbrook thing, so I can kind of get behind you a little bit on Oklahoma City being one of the anti-league pass teams.
Yeah, I mean, There's a couple others that I could think of too that are probably anti-league pass. I think the Orlando Magic are up there for me too. I think it's going to be entirely different once Terrence Ross actually starts playing, because I think that adds a dimension that we haven't seen before. But that team also is kind of just absolutely astonishingly bad at times, and it's hard to watch that team as well. So there's another, a couple others.
Another team for me, and this will be my last one, and I'll let you go. I've chewed up as much of your time as I can take. The Raptors. I just don't like what they do offensively. It's very similar to what you said about Oklahoma City. It's really either DeRozan or Lowry. It'll be interesting to watch with Ibaka in the fold. I might tune in a little more, but it's just there's no creativity in their offense.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with you there as well. To me, the only thing that separates them is they have two players that can do it instead of just one. And I actually kind of like watching the role players on that team, because like Norman Powell has been stepping up big time and players like that. But yes, their offense is predicated on DeMar DeRozan mid-range jump shots like 50% of the time. So you can't really it's just predictable, right? You already know what you're going to see for the most part. You're going to see a Kyle Lowry three pitched out from DeMar DeRozan. DeMar DeRozan's going to go one-on-one 25 to 40% of the time on any given night. And, you know, it's very similar to like the Carmelo Anthony Denver Nuggets. And they were fun to watch for a while, but it's just ISO ball for the most part. And I get you. I mean, like that makes logical sense for the most part. The only difference to me is just that they're actually a decent team. I'm really intrigued actually with this Ibaka deal, because I think that that's going to be an interesting added element to this team as well. So yeah, I'm kind of with you there.
The best part about the Ibaka deal is he's playing the exact role he had in Oklahoma City for essentially the same type of offense.
Yep.
Two guys who are going to be ball dominant. I think he's going to do well for them offensively, because he's going to just stand in the corner, and he's able to hit that corner three pretty consistently now. He's hopefully going to provide defense for them and kind of be rejuvenated a little bit. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting second half of the season, although we're well past the halfway mark, which always makes me weird to me about the All-Star break being so late. I always feel it should be at like around 40, 41 games, but it's around like 50, 51 for teams. Well, Oliver, look, I appreciate your time. Tell the folks, you know, where they can find you, you know, Twitter and whatnot. And thank you for coming on, man.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Omaroney NBA. That's OmaroneyNBA. And I'm also on like Instagram and Facebook and all those different things. So yeah, follow me on Twitter. That's where most of my stuff goes anyways. So yeah, thanks again for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh man, my pleasure, bud. Thank you. And that's it for us. I hope you enjoyed the Jump Ball Podcast. Be sure to like us, rate us, and leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Everybody have a great weekend.